We're starting to see things of patient empowerment, better ways for physicians to use their time, AI to go through all of a patient's data and crystallize it. The net benefit here, multidimensional, is profound.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Interconnected, a new series from Equinix that pulls back the curtain on the digital infrastructure powering today's biggest tech trends. Now, today we're launching a special series called AI Renaissance, where we'll be exploring how AI is reshaping everything from drug discovery to quantum computing. Now, Kyle, today we're going to be kicking off this one with one of the most personal and impactful domains of all, you know, healthcare. And imagine a world where most illnesses never become a crisis because, you know, AI is catching these problems early.
Yeah, Shanil, I'm super excited because we've got two amazing guests with us today. One's a tech leader who helped modernize the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention as the chief software architect, and he's now building a company at the cutting edge of healthcare, at the intersection of blockchain and AI. And he will help us unpack the tension between centralized and decentralized healthcare data.
Yeah, I'm super excited as well. But, you know, before we get into that, we're going to be hearing from a true pioneer in medicine, AI, and longevity science. You may know him, Dr. Eric Topol. He's a geneticist, scientist, cardiologist, and executive vice president of Scripps Research, the largest nonprofit biomedical research institute in the U.S. With over 370,000 citations, Dr. Topol ranks among the top 10 most cited researchers in medicine. His latest book, Super Agers, explores how AI can revolutionize everything from cancer screenings to chronic disease prevention. Dr. Topol, it is such an honor to have you here today. I am so excited to dive right in.
Oh, much appreciated, Shanil.
Dr. Topol, let's begin by looking at the big picture. If everything goes to plan, in a best case scenario, integrating AI into modern healthcare systems, what does that world look like in 5 to 10 years? Or what might be that dream scenario within our line of sight?
Well, I think the big potential here, I mean, there are many dimensions to it, but the one that excites me the most is the ability to prevent the major age-related diseases, cardiovascular, cancer, and neurodegenerative. We never had that capacity. We've talked about it for a long, long time. But now, by integrating many layers of data, that potential is right before us.
So how might that happen? How would AI facilitate the improvement or the elimination of those types of issues?
Right. So we know these three diseases take at least 20 years. From the time they get started to the time they actually clinically manifest. And they all involve a defective immune system, so-called immunosenescence, and untoward inflammation with aging, known as inflammaging. It turns out if we have all the layers of data for a person, the electronic health record and their labs and their images, and you add these other features like, for example, the retina picture analyzed by AI, genes like polygenic risk score, proteins, and biomarkers, you can pick up the ones who are at increased risk for these three major diseases long before they ever would have the first symptoms. And that gives us the opportunity to go into high gear prevention, which not only includes lifestyle factors that many people are familiar with, but even more than ones that we've recognized in recent times, but added to that, you know, specific medications that block this process over time so that we can really prevent these diseases. It's really exciting opportunity.
Yeah, this is going to be groundbreaking for preventative care for sure. I think you have some estimate of like when, how close we are to it. Like, can you give us like in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we can do this now. The we're missing one part of the story, which is being able to get a quantitative assessment of our immune system. Our immune system is really a key driver to these three diseases. So, for example, if your immune system is intact, it's very hard to get cancer spread throughout your body. And so we don't have a clinical way right yet, although people are starting to work on it. That's the one piece missing, but we still can work with what we have. So, for example, with Alzheimer's disease, if you have a family history, you have a high polygenic risk score, you have an APOE4, about a fourth of us have, you can get a p-tau217 test now, and that will determine whether you really are at increased risk. And if you go into an exercise, weight loss, healthy diet, good sleep quality, you can reduce your risk markedly with that biomarker. So we have ways even now to prevent each of these diseases, but we're going to amp it up pretty darn soon.
What does it look like to map that immune system, and maybe in layman's terms?
Yeah. Well, it's the most complex system in our body, and relative to the brain, which is the most complex organ in the body. But it's got cellular components like B cells, T cells, natural killer cells, dendritic cells, lots of different cells that are operating, but also antibodies, antibodies that can be self-directed or directed against a pathogen. So in order to get a handle on this, you want to know every pathogen the person's exposed to, all the viruses throughout their lifetime. You want to know, do they have antibodies directed to themselves? What type of antibodies do they have? How functional are their B cells and their T cells? Which you can find also by doing sequencing of their receptors. And so there's a lot we can get. In fact, there are different startup companies that are working on different pieces. No one has yet done the whole comprehensive sweep, but that's in the works, I think. And once we can do that, that'll be part of an annual assessment, particularly in people at increased risk. And it doesn't have to be very expensive. And it turns out right now, Kyle, there's an immune system clock based on proteins that is becoming available. You know, I wrote about it in the book, which is exciting because this is the first cut to have tap into our immune system. And this will tell you if your immune system is older than pace of aging is faster than your chronological age. So when you see that it is by, you know, a few years, several years, you know you have a problem with the immune system. Whereas if it's younger than you, your immune system, that's a really good, healthy sign. So we're already now within months of having a test like that available. And that's going to make a big difference because that's such a driver. There's a recent paper just published about how the immune system is the key to health span. But so what's amazing is here it is 2025, and we haven't had a good way previously to assess it.
Wow. I'm very interested. Sign me up for one of those tests when they become available.
I've seen a few people actually do them. I've watched a few videos before, and I've seen people get really excited that they're a little bit younger than their actual age. I think I'm just fearful, like if I go ahead and do that and it tells me I'm 35, I might actually, my immune system might get worse because of the stress.
So that's one of the things to keep in mind. There's a lot of these different clocks, okay? So the one that is being sold commercially a lot is the so-called epigenetic methylation clock. Mm-hmm. It's body-wide, and a lot of these companies are charging a large amount for this, you know, a couple hundred dollars. It should be about $10. It's very easy. It's done through saliva. And if it's done in capable hands, like in academic labs, it's actually useful, but it's not nearly as helpful as organ clocks. So if I were to say your brain, your heart, your immune system, kidney, liver, that's where you start to really, you know, hone in on where there might be a problem, because the overall body-wide clock isn't nearly as helpful as these specific organ and organ system clocks.
Got it. Okay. Well, zooming back to what we had spoken about before, you said that you think we are already there, or we're just a few months away from being at that point. What's next? What's needed? What are the next steps that we need to take?
Yeah, that's a great question, because the problem is the medical community moves sclerotic, ossified. It's very difficult, right? And we've been in the genomic era for two decades, and you wouldn't know it in the clinic. And now we're in the proteomic protein era, it's really happening fast with these organ clocks and biomarkers, like I mentioned, the p-tau 217, and the medical community hasn't shifted at all. So this is probably going to be a grassroots patient, savvy patient-driven thing, because otherwise there's such resistance to change. It's really unfortunate. It shouldn't take this long. I mean, so much of this is available today, or as I mentioned, the protein organ clocks will be available later this year. So it's really unfortunate, the lag from great body of evidence and new knowledge to the implementation in routine medical practice.
So, Dr. Topol, you said it will very likely be patient-driven. I'm curious, as somebody outside of the medical community, but clearly a patient, what are some things that I could do or anyone listening could do to drive that as a patient?
Yeah, well, there's so far you can go in terms of, you know, like I mentioned, if you have a family history of Alzheimer's, you know, or polygenic risk score, which, by the way, are not hard to obtain and they're relatively inexpensive. And in the book, I gave 10 different companies that are doing these now. So people should have their polygenic risk score, which are these genomic variants, hundreds of variants for each of these conditions, the different common cancers, heart disease, and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases. And so you know from that whether you have some liability. That doesn't change over time. It only tells us yes or no and the extent of the risk. But some of these newer tests, like the Alzheimer's, will also tell us when. So within that 20-year time frame, if there's high risk, how far are you in that along that arc, especially when you have a repeat test, you know, 6 months or a year later. So the only other issue is the AI. So we haven't yet seen the multimodal AI models that have put all this together that have been made available.
So this concept of multimodal AI, could you tell us more about the implications of that?
Yeah, so there's all these different layers of data, and they're not all of the same type. They're different modes of data. So it could be the scans that you've had. It could be that you had a retinal scan, which it's a gateway to almost all these diseases. It could be your genome or your polygenic risk score, or it could be these protein biomarkers. It could be a multi-cancer early detection test. It could be your lab tests, which the doctor and you always looked at through your portal. Everything looked normal, no asterisk, but it turns out the AI picks up that the trends are in the wrong direction. Missed by patient and doctor. All these layers of data that have to come together to then at that point in time with the entire body of medical knowledge, which is changing every day, improving every day, to say, Kyle, you're at risk for this condition and here's what you can do to prevent it. Or at the very least, put it off by a decade or longer. So that virtual coach aspect, or even one that informs a clinician, physician, that is the aggregating all this data, integrating it. That's the piece that is we're waiting for. But you can get a lot of it without the AI. The AI, though, you're talking about billions of data points for any given person. That's why you need AI. No human could really process all the data. Add on, you might be wearing sensors. You might be having your physical activity, your sleep, your heart rate, your stress level. These also are part of the story as well. So it's a lot of data for any given person.
Yeah, that's so revolutionary. I just had my annual physical a couple of months ago. And of course, I get all of my data, like from my blood tests and everything in my patient portal. And it's all Greek to me, right? I have to go look it all up on the internet. I'm messaging my physician. Is this number okay? And he says, I'm not concerned about it. And here are the reasons why. And I'm processing and I've got wearables and all these other things that he doesn't have. My physician doesn't have access to. So, man, I really look forward to that day that a system that is interpreting all of this is translating and giving me recommendations. That's where we're headed?
Yes, no question. It's just a matter of when, and it always takes longer than it should. Right. But there's still work that can, in a lot of us, can be done even today. But we're just going to get better and better with these pieces that are missing. We've identified the two big pieces. One, a better way to tap into the immune system of a person at that point in time, which unfortunately gets loses its integrity as we age. Not like you two, which who are very young, but, you know, for old dogs like me, you know, that's when you start to see the immune system goes down a bit. But then also, you know, that AI validation of the models, which the big tech is working on this, but there isn't one out there that's, you know, readily available.
Well, shifting gears just a little bit to what we were talking about before, you know, do you think we're on that right trajectory to realize, like, your future best case scenario? Like, what are we seeing for innovation, even like for building trust with our the hospital and doctors? I know that you were saying that was possibly going to be more patient driven, but like, what is that trajectory looking like for the future?
Yeah, so there's many other dimensions of the AI potential benefits. So already we're seeing, just from the conversation in a clinic visit, that can be not just transcribed fully and make into a better note than the ones that doctors put in their electronic records, but also the content can be used to take care of all the keyboard work, like the pre-authorization, the future appointments, prescriptions, lab tests, procedure, I mean, the works, right? And also nudge the patients about things that were discussed during the visit, like, well, checking the blood pressure or how much physical activity and that sort of thing. So we're seeing a liberation of keyboards to some extent with a few hours a day of less keyboard time, just data clerk work that clinicians don't want to do, which potentially gives more time with patients and stop looking at screens and start looking at the patients eye to eye and being present, engendering trust and demonstrating true care of patients. So that's a biggie, and that's starting to happen really right now. Also, more patient engagement with their data. That is already happening, not only with the sensor data, for example, but also there's the being able to diagnose common things like an arrhythmia through a smartwatch, a urinary tract infection through an AI kit that can be had from a pharmacy, ear infections through a smartphone app of children, skin rashes. So being able to prevent having to go to the doctor to get the screening diagnosis. So we're starting to see things of patient empowerment, better efficient ways for physicians to use their time, AI to go through all of a patient's data and crystallize it. So it saves hours of clicking through pages of all different persons' electronic records. So there's lots of ways that AI can make a difference. It's starting to happen now. There's also a backlash against AI, which is the idea that the public is seeing all these things about hallucinations and errors and bias. And yeah, there's a lot of aspects that we have to work on. But the net benefit here, multidimensional, is profound, and eventually we'll get on that benefit track, I'm sure, and it's already taking hold now.
Yeah, you know, speaking of that benefit track, what do you believe we'll get treatments for first?
Well, I'm definitely with you that we need better treatments for many of these conditions, but
yeah,
even better is preventing them. That's why I'm really stressing that that's a whole lot better to get, just prevent them, then you don't have to get these treatments. However, the treatments is another part of the story. As you know, there are now over 50 companies that are into AI-driven drug discovery. And some of them are really making headway. For example, a phase 2 trial of a drug against idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, which is a very hard condition to treat, we don't have good treatments, has already shown marked benefit, and there are many more of these coming. In fact, even during the pandemic of COVID, we saw an AI-discovered drug repurposed, a drug that was used for rheumatoid arthritis, now is shown to improve survival in people with severe COVID requiring hospitalization. So AI is helping treatments. It's going to make a difference where, you know, we have a paucity of treatments or effective treatments. Many of the treatments in cancer are not, they may extend life for a couple few months, but they're not great and they're very expensive. And I'm hoping we can do a whole lot better there. The problem is most treatments are not cures. And that's part of the problem we have is that we can't rely on the treatment side to make huge differences as much as we can on the prevention side. But we will see better treatments. We're already starting to see that in recent times, and that's very encouraging. So I'm sure we're on that path to see many more in the short term ahead.
Right. But the true winner there is probably like getting ahead of it. So that preventative care is going to be really key to our future.
Yeah. And to emphasize, you know, we didn't have any way to do that before. You know, we could not prevent, really prevent cancer and Alzheimer's disease, and even cardiovascular. We had very limited tools. And so this is what I consider the next frontier for AI in healthcare, because now things have really come together. And by the way, when you tell people this is what you should eat, this is how you should exercise, this is how you should sleep, very few people adopt any of those things. But when you say, you know what, you have a risk of Alzheimer's in the next 15 years, and this is what you can do, then you see much better uptake of recommendations when it's specified, particularized to you. So even some of the things that we've known for some time get much better pickup when it is about that person's real medical story.
Right. You really put that into perspective.
Yeah. This makes a big difference.
Dr. Topol, it's likely that our listener base has a substantial number of technologists, engineers, application developers, those involved in the AI ecosystem, maybe even starting technology companies. What would be like your big ask from that community, how they could help move this along in pursuit of everything that you've just said today?
Well, I'd love to see them help us get these multimodal models for prevention for age-related diseases going. We've never been in a better position to do that. But the more groups that get involved with that, the faster and better will be the outputs. So I'd love to see some managed competition to get there, the highest robust models, so that we'll be off to the races. This is such an extraordinary time in medicine that we have, but it does rely on the human expertise. You can't just, go to a chatbot and say, get me some models for this. This is going to be a bit of a challenge because, as we've learned, when you have time series data added to all these other layers of data, it's not such an easy integration challenge. And so that's where we need some of the real experts out there.
Challenge accepted.
Yeah, right. This has been such a wonderful conversation, Dr. Topol. I've learned so much. I'm especially looking forward to reading Super Agers. I know you said we need to start young and getting ahead of it. So I feel like you were really speaking to me today, and I'm so happy that you took the time out to talk to us.
Yeah, I've enjoyed it. And remember that if you start at age 50, you get 7 to 10 years of healthy aging. If you start even earlier than 50, you get even more years. So that's why hopefully it'll be an inspiration we're going to make a huge difference and we can put a big dent into the major diseases that compromise our health span.
After that fascinating look at where healthcare is heading and how AI is already changing the landscape in healthcare, we're going to be shifting gears a bit now and talk about what it actually takes to take that vision real, behind the scenes in the infrastructure.
And we're joined by Jim Nasser, an expert who's worked inside one of the largest public health systems in the world and now leads an award-winning company building decentralized, future-ready healthcare tech. He's the former chief software architect at the CDC, has co-authored several books, created a course on token economics for the University of Georgia, and guest lectured at institutions like Harvard and Georgetown. As CEO of ACOR, he and his team are tackling some of the toughest problems in medicine today with a sharp focus on cancer care. Jim, it's so great to have you.
Yeah, thank you, Kyle and Shunil. It's a pleasure to speak with you both, and I appreciate that introduction.
Yeah, I'm so looking forward to just diving into this conversation. So let's just get started. And I want to start by talking about infrastructure impact. Now, I want to hear your thoughts on what do you think are the biggest infrastructure concerns or, you know, maybe the opportunities when it comes to the integration of AI innovations into healthcare?
Yeah, certainly. You know, if we had this conversation, Shunil, maybe a year and a half ago, and we had posed the same question, I think costs of cloud, costs of storage, would have been number one in terms of infrastructure. You know, that's basically what we had seen at scale, working with big enterprises and also from my own background. I think now, if you look at infrastructure, there's a couple of things. Cost is certainly an overriding, I think, issue. I think AI in particular consumes a lot of resources, kind of energy, but also a lot of financial resources. So that's definitely one. But then there's also, you know, the ongoing issue of storage and processing or compute power. And how do you do it? How do you make it sustainable? So I think those are really big infrastructural kind of questions that or challenges that will continue, and AI really accelerates it. I think if you look at it from another angle, and this is one that we're acutely kind of aware of just because there's always a budget concern, you know, is how do you do infrastructure in a way where you don't centralize all of the compute power or all of the data training, as example, and also make it more sustainable economically and from an energy consumption perspective. And that's, Carl, you were mentioning my background about decentralized technologies. That's some of the reasons why we do that.
So, Jim, cloud and storage are probably essential and givens in the landscape of technology that we're in. So what kind of ideas or solutions would you propose to lowering those economics or cost of cloud and storage?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there are a number of things that you need to look at. I think just going back to kind of the domain that we're focused on at ACOR, but also in this conversation, in the health space, really the majority of data, I've heard as much as 97%, is private data is within the enterprise. And oftentimes it's actually not on the cloud natively. You know, many times it's on local data centers or even smaller servers, and then it's uploaded to the cloud. So part of this, you know, kind of scenario is, do you need to move the data to the cloud to begin with? Do you need to, you know, in order, and then oftentimes it's done because people are trying to do discovery, they're trying to learn from the data or do analytics and reporting and things like this. So the question, I think that's really where I would start, the first principle is, does the data need to move? Do you need to put it in the cloud? What is the specific reason for doing this? I think once you've kind of done that, then particularly with AI in mind, then the next question, you know, if the data is private, and I think we would all pretty much agree to this, is how do you do private compute? How do you do private AI training, a model training, model lineage, things like this? And it turns out, even with that lens in mind, there are a number of things you can do that are not necessarily on the cloud, or at least the cloud as we would, you know, traditionally define it, maybe on like an Amazon type of server. You know, there are things you can do, maybe using some cloud resources, but it's really much more of a private, you know, if you like an edge compute type of model. So, I mean, those are some ways. I think that there's a lot to be said for really understanding your data and how do you minimize like this idea of data minimization and really what needs to be exposed to various services. You know, is that efficient? I think that there are a lot of techniques you have to consider with all of that. And I think finally, certainly from where we come from, you know, we think that a decentralized approach, you know, where you're using possibly much lower, you know, cost resources, maybe they're decentralized, distributed, there's multiple nodes, if you like, that's an alternative, right? You know, again, it's not to say that's the only reason why you want to consider decentralized technologies. I think there's a lot of other things to do with control and basically making yourself less of a security vector and more accountable. There's a number of other reasons for decentralized, but certainly sustainability is one reason.
I can imagine that people in the healthcare world right now, and probably like their IT teams are going crazy talking about putting data in the cloud, like with all of the different regulations, GDPR. How do you think we're getting to that point where these teams can become more trusting of putting this in a more decentralized location rather than like locally at these like hospitals and medical facilities?
You know, Chanel, that's a really good question because are the teams going to become more trusting? I mean, based on the evidence that I've seen, I would say no, not in healthcare, not yet. Is it because the technology isn't there or it can't be proven that in fact, by being decentralized, it could be even more secure? I think the answer is no, because, you know, at the technology level, there's quite a bit of maturity now. We can prove this out in smaller scale, but there's definitely an inertia problem, you know, and I think, you know, one of the topics I come up a little bit earlier was around preventative healthcare and giving more control to patients. That is great, but if all of your electronic health records are managed by one gigantic vendor, and then in turn, they basically enable one very big high-tech AI firm to provide discovery, you know, effectively, you're leaning into a model that's all about centralized control by one or two entities. You know, and that's really, I mean, if you go outside of that particular network, like a hospital network, and you want to be interacting as a patient with other sources, that's really not a good place to be. And certainly it makes it extremely uncompetitive for many of the, you know, many of the innovators in this space. And I think it largely feeds into one or two big companies. So, but I would say from a sentiment perspective, yes, certainly it's still a challenge.
So, Jim, we just talked to Dr. Eric Topol, and he really talked about the multimodal needs for data in medicine and healthcare. And it really opened our eyes to just how segregated this is going to be. I mean, I walk away from that assuming that it's a given that our patient data will be highly decentralized. And you've been at the core of decentralized and open systems in your career. So maybe could you walk us through a little bit more of an understanding of how the architecture of that works in medicine? Or if you have a specific example that would be useful to lay out, like help us understand how the decentralization really works and maybe how patients can ultimately be in control of that data.
Yeah, certainly. And again, I think from a vision perspective, I don't disagree with Dr. Topol. That it makes sense, in like intuitively it would make sense that, you know, with these wearables that we have, if not that, but more than just that, patient reported outcomes. You mentioned, Kyle, a little bit earlier, we're working cancer. Certainly, you know, more and more of the rare diseases, you know, there's smaller communities and you know, this engaging with the right community, with the underserved community requires you know, it doesn't require, but certainly you could go down a more decentralized path. You know, you can incentivize them through all kinds of ways. You could do it in lower, much lower scale, yet still be efficient. So all that from a vision perspective, that makes sense to me. And I think if you take certain parts of the world under certain regulations, for instance, in Europe, they have just enacted the European Health Data Space regulations, which explicitly says that patient data is owned by the patients. And if you don't actively drive that, you know, there's fines, kind of like the GDPR, as you were mentioning, Chanel. And then certain parts of the world, such as African countries, I think that there's much more openness, you know, to this idea that the patient, you know, is owning data and the vendors are involved in helping that. However, in the US, which I mean, this conversation, we are in the US and, you know, in many ways, because of the amount of money there and the amount of influence, is the one that tends to be front of mind. I think in the U.S., it's still, you know, we're still some long ways from really patient-owned data. And I think if for no other reason that there is significant disincentives for the current vendors to make that happen, you know, and even the laws that we have, like such as the Cures Act or, you know, like the these exchange protocols such as TEFCA, they're not highly enforceable. There isn't punitive, penalties if you don't do it. It's more of a, do the right thing type of thing, but it doesn't necessarily mean that's going to happen. So again, I'm a little bit skeptical on how quickly this will happen in the US, even though I think there's some natural forces. I think interestingly, particularly in the last 6 months or so, I think there's a new factor coming in, which is the traditional sources for funding big research that they're drying up. For instance, these very large grants at NIH or USAID and things like this. So in some ways that may drive, just through necessity being the mother of invention type of idea, that might drive more of a, how do we do this, for instance, cancer research in a smaller way with less money, perhaps directly connecting to patients. So I do see that happening. I just don't necessarily see it happening at very large scale, anytime soon in the US. I think if you kind of take that aside, I think that there's a number of reasons to believe that decentralized really makes sense from a patient perspective. Ultimately, all of us here in the US, even if you're within like the largest networks, it's very, very likely you have multiple records within different systems. And certainly if you go from one function to another, if you go from your general practitioner to your orthopedic, for sure it's different systems. And none of that really helps in terms of usability for the patient or the value for the patient.
Yeah, I mean, I've lived that and experienced it. I have multiple hospital systems and doctors and care, and I'm multiple patient portals. And I find that, somewhat frustrating to traverse and navigate. But if I play back what you just said a few minutes ago, Jim, it sounds like somewhat nation or sovereign dependent. So certain nations are closer towards a centralized model than others. There's probably always going to be an element of decentralization because of some things that we as patients own, like wearables, and in nations like the United States, where there is maybe some choice in care and different networks and physicians and hospitals. And so we've got to work through that. Is there anything we as patients can do to try to help drive or force or influence that?
So that is the good news, which is yes. So in America and in many other countries around the world, you can use basically your agency to essentially ask for your data. You can share your data with whoever you want to, including third parties or your caretakers. And you can do it legally. In America, there's this thing called the Cures Act, but it's actually a law. It allows, its purpose is to remove information blocking. It's allow more interoperability. It's to really give you as a patient the choice to take your data from wherever it happens to be. It's typically within one very large electronic health record system, but be able to get it. Like, so you mentioned, Kyle, that you have multiple systems. I bet you go to like a MyChart and you're able to look at your records. You do a download as a PDF. You could even possibly download as a like an XML or maybe even have an API. Those are ways in which you're allowed to do it. I think, so yes, you can do it. What would it take to do it? I think there's an inertia challenge that we do have to work on, which is really helping patients understand like the so what, like why should you do this? Why does it matter? What do you get out of it? What's the value of going through this discomfort of getting your data, downloading it, maybe uploading it somewhere else, being incentivized to share it? And I think that's something that, honestly, I feel like, again, there's some, in particularly in certain regions, there are some disincentives. Like as example, you're not going to see I'm not going to mention the names, but all of us know the big EHRs. You're not going to see the biggest EHR vendor go out there and provide like a massive education campaign on patient data sharing, with third parties and managing your own wearables data and your full genetic testing data and your EHR data all within your app of choice. So I think that's part of the kind of reality what we're dealing with. I think, that, like I mentioned, in certain countries, the law is really kind of much more forceful and really much more proactive, you know, in saying, look, as a patient, not only do you have your agency and choice, but now we're forcing that all of the systems and the networks actually provide this to you as by default, as opposed to you having to go way out of your way to kind of change this situation from a centralized vendor-owned model to one that, you know, is much more about data ownership at the patient level.
So we need some more advocacy in that area, because you said some countries are definitely doing this, but we don't really have a lot of that here today. I guess what some of the things that I would like to understand too, Jim, is what do you think needs to happen for our infrastructure edge to actually like make that work at scale? Because, you know, we're not there yet, but what are some of the things that you think we need to be doing?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question, Shanil. I would say, you know, again, to me, the biggest problem isn't a technology or infrastructure. I think a lot of that actually is in decent place. I think even usability, you know, at the app level or whatever, wearables, it's really pretty decent. And it's in line with consumer level expectations. I think what is in there, as example, you know, here in America, is for your physician who's already overburdened, you know, has really no time for even the core administrative things, to be then incentivized to talk to you as a patient and say, look, you know, here are ways in which you could own your data. You know, I suggest that you download it, put it on your MyChart, or even synchronize it from your Apple Health app and things like this. I think that's the level that we're just not seeing. And you know, the relationship between patients and health networks is almost entirely to a trusted provider relationship. But those providers then inadvertently are becoming gatekeepers to, you know, to letting or kind of providing advocacy for these patients, because they're already overburdened. They don't really know that they're struggling to catch up with the myriad of things that are brand new, such as these AI tools that you know, we spoke about a little bit earlier. I think in terms of infrastructure, I'm actually pretty confident that, like, right now, if you said, like, can we go large scale decentralized, you know, and it'd be secure, it'd be verifiable, it'd be lower cost, you know, it'll lower central governance. Can you kind of guarantee those things? My answer would be yes. I think the infrastructure is there. I think that there's some work to be done on things such as, you know, edge computing and making that more available and things like this, or verifiable, or confidential AI. But honestly, I feel like those are really already in good enough shape to certainly start, you know, kind of scaling. But there are some other things that we have to address, and some of those really have nothing to do with technology.
Jim, what would be the best case with AI in that decentralized world?
Yeah, you know, it's a really good question. I'm a little bit biased, but I will say the best case for AI, you know, almost in any context, but decentralized, is that you're able to do private AI using your so AI that's run in a private, secure way, where you as owner of the data or as like the, you know, the researchers, if you like, you have full visibility about the AI model, its lineage, its explainability of where things are coming from. You're able to see verifiable kind of data training. Because ultimately, I think, you know, the question is, well, why are you doing AI? Well, you want to make things faster. You want to drive innovation. But if you cannot trust the results, or if there's a chance that things are hallucinated and then can have significant human or safety impact, well, that's a no-go, right? Nobody's going to want to buy into that. So I would say that really the best case is we can do private AI and do it as fast, you know, if not faster than central, or like cloud-based AI, maybe do it much more on a much more contextual basis. So not foundational models, you know, with a trillion, you know, tokens or variables, but maybe it's I'll give you a specific example. We're working right now with one of our clients in the public sector on discovery from autopsies. So, you know, we don't need to have hundreds of billions of variables to train our model. Maybe we need 100,000. So that's a much more smaller model, but being able to do that using private data, do it in a way that's secure and cost efficient and decentralized. So they don't come back to us and say, well, Jim, now we have to trust you guys and your small company. I think those are the kind of things that to me really is where AI should be driving towards in healthcare for sure, because the data is private. The data is not in the cloud. And also, frankly, going back to our conversation up to now, Shanil and Kyle, the idea is for patients to own the data. So if patients are owning the data, if Jim, you know, and Kyle and Shanil, if we individually own the data, then supposedly we are individually giving consent for that data to be used in specific contexts. So that's a very much a decentralized model. I don't, if I'm providing consent, I don't want to give a blank check consent for one EHR to use my data for rest of time. That's not that kind of difficult object. I think it's about, can you do AI privately and sustainably, but in a much smaller context than these giant foundational models?
Yeah, I know you said you can get better results with more data, right? So I feel like there is this conflict that we're experiencing where you want data abundance, but we're also moving to this era of like sovereignty, right? So it's like there's a bit of conflict between the data abundance and the sovereignty. How do you think that we should be able to, or what's one thing that you could say to our customers or customers in general to help them to want to donate data for the greater good?
Yeah. So, I mean, again, this is where I think, depending on context, Shanil, there is some beachhead. So I'll give you specific examples. A few years ago, we were working within the neuroblastoma clinical research space. It's a deadly form of a pediatric cancer. So it turns out, not just for neuroblastoma, but almost any number of rare diseases or deadly diseases, that really the much greater need is to find treatment, find that clinical trial. That's hard to find here. It's hard to get into. Find patient communities to exchange information with. Honestly, even if it's just through kind of like wide open Facebook pages, you know, or very simple to kind of set up Facebook pages. So I think those are areas where the patients are really already proactive. They're motivated to share. They're typically very educated. You know, it's this area where these patients, their caretakers, they go very deep. They really understand a lot of the science and a lot of the treatment. So obviously, starting there is actually best case scenario, because they're already motivated. They really don't even need to be extra incentivized, other than perhaps this idea that our data is going to be used for the greater good, just like you were saying. It will help, you know, with improving clinical research, with improving access to trials, things like this. I think the next thing, and this is where I think that we're now kind of in this infancy of the DeSci space, the decentralized science, which is, can we tap into individuals? As we would through, you know, like social media apps,
yeah.
But incentivize them to provide their health data, whether it's through wearables, you know, whether it's like, we do quite a bit of work, as example, like you mentioned, Kyle, with cancer, but tracking things like inflammation, you know, which is at the core of cancer, is one of the causalities of cancer. That's really important, getting that data. So their inflammation, inflammation trackers, and you know, you can provide some incentives for kind of the general population to provide the data. Very similarly around women's cycles and women's health. I think that's an area where we see that maybe the incentivization is just through like a easier to use app or strategic placement of these scientific initiatives within things that people already are doing, you know, such as their wearables apps and things like this. So, or perhaps even like going back to the wearables, you know, if we have like a CGM, a continuous glucose monitor, perhaps using that to track other kind of biomarkers as well, which is, you know, technically possible using these microneedle technologies. So to me, all of these things are really like the next level and you know, relatively straightforward to conceive and probably relatively low cost to get some kind of scale with. Then I think, you know, if we go further down, I think for things like kind of, I would say more general population health, to me that the really interesting approach is around preventative health, around things like longevity. You know, we see people like Martin Johnson out there doing, tracking everything under the sun. I think that's where you kind of get into much more proactive, people who are really proactive about health, maybe athletes or influence. Yeah. And I'm optimistic that there are ways, there are some beachheads for making this happen.
So we're there. We're close, and we're getting there. And I think that what you're saying is also like the infrastructure is also almost there. So I'm hoping that our listeners and not just professionals in the healthcare, but also patients can listen to this and also be more trusting about sharing data for the greater good.
A huge thank you to our guests today for helping us reimagine what healthcare could be with AI as the accelerant.
And you know what, Kyle? This is just the first in our AI Renaissance series. I definitely recommend you sticking with us because the future is coming fast and it's going to be intelligent.